Hello and welcome. This is Colleen O'Grady, the host of the Power Your Parenting Moms to Teens podcast. This is a gathering place for moms of preteens, teens, and young adults. My mission is to first and foremost support and encourage you, mom, so that you can live well and reclaim your life. Two, the show will help you have the best possible relationships with your teens so that you can communicate, motivate, and guide them effectively and actually enjoy them. And third, I will bring you top-notch guests who will share the newest in adolescent research and trends so you can be prepared and aware of what your teens are facing today. Always, you will leave each episode armed with practical parenting tips. Welcome back, everyone, to the 268th episode of Power Your Parenting, Moms with Teens podcast. I'm Colleen O'Grady, the host of the show. Today, we are going to discuss how to implement reflective parenting versus reactive parenting. Our guest today is Sheila Redfern, PhD, a consultant clinical child and adolescent psychologist. She is currently a head of clinical services for family trauma at Anna Freud, a children and families mental health charity in London, UK. Dr. Redfern also worked as a senior lecturer as part of Guy's Medical School from 1996 to 2005. She is the director of Redfern Psychological Services, an independent clinical psychology practice where she offers direct clinical work, training, and supervision, and where she is devoted to promoting insight, compassion, and empathy in individuals, families, institutions, and communities. Dr. Redfern's clinical psychology practice spans 30 years, and she has published extensively in peer-reviewed journals on parenting, fostering, and child and adolescent mental health for the professional audience. Dr. Redfern has authored two books for parents, Reflective Parenting, A Guide to Understanding What's Going On in Your Child's Mind, and How Do You Hug a Cactus? Reflective Parenting with Teenagers in Mind. So welcome, Dr. Sheila Redfern.
Nice to meet you, Colleen.
Yes, I'm so glad that you're here. So the first question I ask all my guests is, are you a mom? And if so, what are the ages of your kids?
I am a mom. I have three boys. I have twins who are 21 years old, so adults, young adults.
Yes.
And I have a younger son who's 15. I'm very heavily in boy world, I guess. I have only boys. I miss the company of women.
Yes, yes. So you recently wrote a book called How Do You Hug a Cactus? Reflective Parenting with Teenagers in Mind. So can you tell us a little bit why you wrote this book and maybe a little bit of the background story?
So this is my second book. I wrote the original book, Reflective Parenting, in 2016, and that was primarily for parents with younger kids. So what we would say in the UK, primary school age kids, I suppose, sort of babies to 12 years old, kind of pre-teens. That was really based around theories from attachment, mentalizing, which we can talk about a little bit if you want to. And it was a model that I developed. So I really wanted to see how this would work in practice. The impetus for that first book was how to bring some of those theories alive for the parents that I was working with clinically, but also a little bit in my own parenting and through the circle that I know of parents through my own life. And then following on from the success of that book, as my own children started to get older and go through the teen years, then I was working a lot with teenagers. A lot of people were saying to me, come on, where's the parent book for teenagers? My kids are older now. That was really helpful then. But now there's this whole new stuff that I'm dealing with. And of course, as you know very well yourself, it is a whole different territory when you get into adolescence. So this book, How Do You Hug a Cactus, was how does this approach of reflective parenting need to be adapted when you have a teenager and a young adult? Because I go all the way up to mid-20s. Mm-hmm. That's something that I really think is important to think about, is adulthood doesn't suddenly start when someone turns 18 or even 19. You know, it's still going on. The brain's still developing, as you know, right into the mid-20s. So how do you parent somebody through that period and help them navigate the world and their life. So I really wanted to bring that to that next stage of development. The idea of how do you hug a cactus was that the parents that I was talking to a lot through my clinical work and that I know through my own life were saying, I just don't know when to get close and when to step back. And the idea of the cactus image was really from this sort of sense that teenagers are a bit spiky at times. They can be a bit prickly and they can give you the message like, get the hell away from me. Like, don't touch me. Don't get near me. And yet at the same time, there's this other message of where are you when I need you? You know, how do I stay close to you? And I think that's an idea that's and a theory that's obviously very familiar to people who understand attachment theory, that there's something really important about staying present in the mind of somebody who's going through this period of individuation and separation. They want you to back off, but they also want to know that you're still close and available. So that's really kind of where the impetus for the book came from, was to think about what that looks like and feels like for parents.
Yeah. Well, you and I have a lot in common. You know, we've both been in practice about the same amount of years. And I did write two books basically when I was going through it with my own daughter. So, Dial Down the Drama, you know, had been in the academia world. And so I didn't write an academic book. I wrote a, like, you know, grounded science in it, but it was like I was a mom in the trenches with my own daughter. And so yeah, Dial Down the Drama is kind of the high school years. And then I just think those young adult years or the emerging young adult years are sometimes the most confusing years for parents. And now you have no control. You know, you just send them off a lot of times, you know, maybe sometimes they're home. But so then Dial the Dream was my second book for moms parenting kids from 18 to 25. And again, you know, I went through the whole thing. And so it was like, oh my gosh, this is so hard. So it's, I think books written and when we're living it with our kids, and we also know the academic theory, I think those are the best books because, you know, our teens and young adults are going to call BS.
Exactly.
So let me ask you, so what does being a reflective parent mean?
So reflective parenting is based around predominantly the theory of, we know as mentalizing. And for people who are listening to that might not have ever heard of that, theory of mentalizing and mentalization-based therapy is also based in theories of attachment and theory of mind. And it's essentially about understanding states of mind, mental states. So again, I try and translate these terms from the kind of academic language into what a parent might think of it. So really boiling that down, it's thoughts and feelings and not looking so much at the external behavior. So, you know, you might have a tantruming 5-year-old, you might have a very sulky 15-year-old, and a behavioral psychologist, so the kind of behavioral intervention or behavioral parenting would be about addressing that behavior and thinking, how do I correct that or fix it or get them to change it? A mentalizing approach and a reflective parent would be thinking about what's the meaning of that behavior? Where does that behavior come from? What are the thoughts and feelings going on, like the backstory, if you like? What's the backstory behind that sulky adolescent or that very upset adolescent or that very shy little child? Where does that behavior come from? And reflective parenting is very much about reflecting on the self as a parent and reflecting on your child. I guess when we talk about empathy, we think about empathy for somebody else. You're really trying to step into their shoes, understand what they feel like, what it's like to be them. I might be thinking, what's it like to be you running this podcast? But when we're being a reflective parent, we're both trying to get behind the other person's behavior, but also reflecting on our own state of mind. And that's something I think that often is missing in parenting interventions and parenting books even, because how can that not be part of the whole dynamic?
Yes.
So if you give you a little example, maybe.
Well, we're going to get into it, because I kind of followed your book and have questions from that.
Okay, sure.
But I think it would be good, maybe the question I think maybe some moms would be thinking right now is, I mean, that just sounds like too much work. I just want to change my teen's behavior. I just want them to study now. I don't want to think about why do they not want to study today. So what are the benefits of being a reflective parent?
Exactly the kind of thing that I would expect a parent to feel. And I was having this conversation just only the day before yesterday with a foster parent who was saying, who's really a fan of this program, but says, you know, people might think, oh, it sounds exhausting. I've got to think about my own mind and somebody else's mind. I haven't got time for this, just wanted to stop. But what evidence shows us is that actually what's behind behavioral problems or emotion difficulties is emotional regulation problems. So when a young person isn't able to regulate, or you might call it manage, their emotions because they're too overwhelming, they're out of their control, that leads to dysregulated behavior, whatever that looks like. It might be externalizing behavior, it might be internalizing behavior. So it might be someone becoming very withdrawn, or it might be someone really acting out and kind of being aggressive or confrontational. And so the reason that it's actually not as much work in the long run is that what I'm helping parents to teach their kids is, how do you regulate your emotions? Because that's the mechanism of change for behavioral problems. So if somebody is feeling really confused about how to, I don't know, navigate their friendship group because they're a teenage girl and they've got lots of different dynamics going on in their, you know, as often happens at school or college, and they can't kind of read the situation, they become overwhelmed by that. And as a result of that, they become maybe confrontational with their parent, or they become maybe self-sacrificing. They might have developed eating difficulties or self-harming difficulties. All of those are really manifestations of an inability to regulate how you feel. And so being a reflective parent is helping the parent to model how to really tune into what you're thinking and feeling. So that's the reason that it involves a bit of work on the parents' part, is because we know that kids are watching us all the time and they're learning from us how to manage these emotions. And if we just bury them and try and fix the behavior, they never learn how to do that. I guess behavioral interventions work in the very short term, but the evidence says they don't really fix behavior in the long run. And so if someone just can't manage their emotions, they're going to continue to let them out in more antisocial ways or more dysfunctional ways. That's really why, even though it might sound like, oh, I've got to think about my own mind, I've got to regulate myself, actually, once that's modeled to their child or their teenager, or they even their young adult, that young person starts to understand how their own mind a little bit better, their own ability to manage these emotions in ways that are more adaptive. And that then leads to just much more kind of manageable, easy dispositions and behaviors. So that's really the kind of mechanism at work.
And I would add to that, which I've heard from teens and young adults, and I'm sure you have too, is teens know if we just want them to change their behavior, or we just are caring about their data points of what grades they're making. And I'll hear from teens and young adults a lot, you know, my parents don't care about me. All they care about is my grades.
Exactly. And I guess that links for me to one of the key principles of reflective parenting, which is feeling understood. So when we feel understood as a, you know, you and I at our age, when we feel understood by somebody, we feel connected to them. That person gets me. They're kind of interested in me, curious about me. It starts to help you feel connected and open up, and you want to learn from somebody, or you want to talk to somebody, you can relate to them. If what you feel is that person's just trying to stop me doing things or make me do certain things that actually don't fit with how we feel, then that causes a disconnect. And that's what causes the distance. I think that's when the cactus comes out, is if a young person's feeling, all you're trying to do is get me to do what you want, you don't understand what I need or what I feel, then often that leads to really defensive behavior, and it leads to that disconnect. And I guess probably through our work, what we've all come across is that 9 times out of 10 parents want to feel close to their kids. You know, I don't meet many parents that don't want to have a relationship with their kids. And that's what we're striving for, is for through these difficult teenage years, for parents to still be able to have that connection. And for me, that comes from teenagers feeling understood.
Yeah, I completely agree. And when I'm talking to moms or speaking to moms, we know this. And the reason why we know this is, you know, if you're married or you have a partner and they just try to change your behavior, like you just need to be on time, we don't feel close to them,
no,
you know?
Exactly.
But we do the same thing to our teens, and we expect them to say, you know, if we say like, you need to, you know, make your skirt longer, or you need to get your homework done, or you need to get in bed earlier, we expect them to say thank you. And they're not going to say thank you. Just as how you would feel if you weren't understood by your partner, you wouldn't feel close to them. So you talk about 3 basic biobehavioral systems: the reward system, the mentalizing, and the stress threat system. So can you help us we're going to break that down, but can you help us understand the reward system in the teenage brain?
I'm sure you've talked about this quite a lot on your podcast. So we know that in these teenage years, the brain is, well, it's growing anyway all through these years, but it's also, it goes through a particular change in this period where that area that's about planning and thinking things through, weighing up situations, considering other people's perspectives, looking at consequences, that's compromised during this stage of development. So that's the area in the prefrontal cortex. And that's, you know, we can look at scans of the brain and we can see that's still developing and that's dialed down, if you like, to use your terminology. So for example, you know, where we as a parent might think, if you don't revise, you're never going to do well on that test. A teenager might not even be thinking about that test because it's 6 days away. And that's something that, you know, and what's more immediately rewarding is a text from their friend that says, meet me at 8 o'clock. We're going for a meetup at Fred's house, whatever. Because that bit of the brain that wants the immediate reward is alive and active. That bit of us that would say, oh, that's not such a good idea because if I have a late night tonight, I'm going to be tired and I'm going to fail my exam in 6 days. I better just like plan to just stay home for the next week and then I can celebrate. That just isn't switched on in adolescence. And that's obviously a source of huge tension between parents and their kids because they're like, don't you get it? If you don't do this now, then that's not going to happen then that often isn't figuring. It doesn't mean it isn't, they don't have that ability, they don't have that capacity, but it's not immediately rewarding. And it's the same reason that a lot of young people take risks. So, I mean, I guess smoking would be a good example of that. You know, if your friends are all smoking a cigarette at a party, and you know that intellectually you could get cancer from smoking, that's going to be far, far out of reach compared to the this will look cool in front of my friends reward, even if you hate the taste of nicotine. So it's that kind of tension that comes between kids and their parents often, because we're tearing our hair out saying, can't you see? And they're not even thinking about that. And of course they can't. And it literally can't see that. And I guess that's something that we have to learn to tolerate our frustration around that. And we'll probably come on to talk about that a bit later, but how do we manage our response?
Yeah. And I wrote some about this in Dial Down the Drama. It's like one of my chapters is like, it's not personal, you know, that teens are hardwired for drama. And so if you know it's not personal and you know it's kind of global, it's universal, then I mean, then the same behavior doesn't frustrate you as much. I mean, it will frustrate you, but it's not as much if you know it's not against you.
But can I just add something to that? Because I think that it's also important to help parents feel validated as well, that it's okay to find that frustrating, you know, just because we know these changes are going on in the brain and we know that exactly, it's not personal, that's sort of unique to this stage of development. It doesn't mean it's not worrying or it doesn't mean it's not hurtful. And it's that sort of balance for me in reflective parenting between how I'm being impacted by my teenager or how a parent I'm working with their understanding of what that behavior is about. And one doesn't cancel out the other. You know, understanding why someone does something doesn't make you feel really, you know, frightened out of your mind that they might just flunk all their exams or that they might start smoking if they like the taste of it. I mean, that's still valid. And I think my book is not about judging parents and saying you just need to understand teenagers more and then you'll be connected. It's really more about understand where they're coming from, but also be clear about what's going on in your mind. That'll be might be something completely different, but you also need to let them know what, you know, you might not be worried about traveling late at night. I get that. For you, it's fun. For me, it's terrifying. And it's that you, me, self, other sort of interplay that I think is really helpful to teenagers because it's teaching them a different perspective as well.
Yes.
But actually, it looks terrifying from where I'm standing. Not telling you should feel like that, but that's how I feel.
That's true. All right. So is it even possible for an adolescent to mentalize?
Yes, it is, but it's much harder. It's much harder because mentalizing is about, you know, there's many principles to mentalizing. And one of them is perspective taking skills. So that understanding that I've just sort of said about self and other, we can do that. And, you know, very young kids can't do that before the age of sort of 3 and a half, 4. You know, if I put my feet, hands over my eyes, peekaboo, I think you can't see me because I can't see you. And it's not quite so extreme in adolescence, but there is an element of that. And there's a dip in their ability to understand other perspectives because of these changes that are happening in the brain, plus all the hormonal changes that they're going through. Teenagers, as we know, become incredibly self-focused. So that lens really, really narrows. As parents, we can often say, you're just being selfish. But actually what's going on is they're hyper-focused on themselves and become, you know, that can obviously turn into something negative. It can be acute self-consciousness then, this sort of feeling of like, or real awkwardness that you see in teenagers where just even one glance feels like you're scrutinizing them. But yes, teenagers can mentalize, but it is harder. It's much harder to step into somebody else's shoes and to understand actually how you see me is this way or how that person sees me is that way. That skill, we have to understand it's harder for them. But what reflective parenting does is help promote that skill in adolescence and help grow that skill. So in a way, the more you're kind of coaching your kids about how different people see the world, the more helpful it is to them, because getting lost in your own perspective can be obviously really harmful. You know, if you decide I'm worthless, I'm unattractive, I'm stupid, and you get really stuck on that perspective and can't see, well, actually, you know, your cousin thinks you're really smart, you know, he's struggling at math, or your friend thinks you're really pretty and she doesn't like her hair or whatever. If you're really stuck in your focus and it's a negative one, then that can, you know, that can lead to really harmful behavior. And so opening up this kind of think of like a perspective taking highway, if you like, is really helpful because you can start to then consider maybe the way I see myself isn't the only way, but it's harder when you're a teenager, much harder because you're very stuck.
That's really helpful. You talk about the stress threat system, and then you talk about the emotional thermometer. So can you explain the emotional thermometer?
Yeah, this is something that I really like to use with parents and with young people. I've used it with little kids as well, and even teachers use it. So it's kind of old fashioned in a way, because thermometers now don't look quite like the thermometers look like in my day. So it's a visual image that probably needs some adaptation, but everyone seems to get it. You know, a thermometer, like, now just stick it in an ear, it's a digital thing. So in a sense, it's quite a quaint old-fashioned thing. But I think everyone understands the concept of a thermometer is going from cold to hot. It's a tool that parents find really helpful because they can visualize, as my emotional temperature rises or as it drops, actually what happens is I lose my ability to think. I would say mentalize, but I could just shorthand that for I lose my ability to think. So example, I might be, say we're talking now on this podcast, I suddenly see somebody kind of appears at my office window, sort of looking really, really alarmed. I'll probably get a little sort of adrenaline burst. I'll feel a bit frightened. What's happened? I'll stop being able to think about what's going on in our conversation. I might become kind of quickly quite stressed. It'll probably pass really quickly as they sort of say, oh, no worries. I can see you're on a call, and they'll go away and then I'll regulate again. That would be the kind of hot end of the thermometer. The cold end of the thermometer is perhaps when we're feeling maybe a bit low, or we might be a bit cut off, you know, kind of even bored. Bored's like a low end. So our arousal level is low. And the thermometer helps parents to recognize that at either end of that scale, they can't think reflectively. So if their teenager or young adult does something that really stresses them out, that's the last kind of moment for really having a reflective conversation. And you know this, we all know this, but it's hard to stop ourselves, you know, because we're kind of activated. But in those moments, we tend to do something less mentalizing, like we might shout, or we might slam a door, or we might just try and stop something quickly. It's helpful in emergency situations. You know, if we saw a little, we had a baby that's crawling towards a plug with its finger, like we do something really quick to act. We're not going to think, oh, I wonder what that means, why they might be crawling towards a plug. When a teenager does something that activates us in that way, it's really important to just take a moment to think, actually, my temperature's too high. I need to bring it down before I can have that conversation. So it's not a new concept that we all know, that actually choose your moment when you can have these conversations. Don't have the, you know, when the iron's hot or in the heat of the moment. But it helps parents visualize it to think, where am I on that thermometer? And what we're trying to get parents to do is think, when am I in the middle range? When am I just warm? You know, I'm not switched off and I'm not really kind of high up this end, like really, really aroused emotionally. And in that middle range, that's when we can have the best kind of conversations with ourselves, with other people, with our partners, and with our kids, because then we're able to mentalize. Then we're able to really think, what was that like for you? Where did that come from? What did you mean by that? In a way that we're not overreacting or underreacting to. Because being switched off can be as unhelpful as being really kind of switched on too much.
That's a very good point. And when I'm talking to moms about this, it's like for both of you, and I know you're implying that, it's like you have to kind of be in that sweet middle place, but so does the teen.
Exactly.
You kind of both have, if you want to have a conversation, the best setup for a good conversation would be if both of y'all in that kind of sweet place.
Yeah.
So I want to get into the parent. So what is the parent map and how does that affect parenting a teen? You have an acronym of MAP.
So it's mentalizing adolescent parenting. So it's mentalizing yourself as a parent to an adolescent. And you could think of a map as having like any number of destinations and points on it. So your map in a way can just be huge. And it's a work in progress for all of us for most of our life. But I use the model to help parents try and think about what are the pointers on my map that influence how I am as a parent of an adolescent. It might be stuff from my own childhood, my own adolescence. It could be my culture, my religious beliefs. It could be my gender, it could be sexuality, it could be age, it could be economic status. It's literally anything. But what we try to get parents to think a little bit about, what are the main things that are influencing me? And the reason that map can change is because your current circumstances clearly can change. Something that influences me right now might be very different from something that influenced me 2 years ago. You know, maybe you have a parent who's much better off socioeconomically right now than they were 2 years ago, or worse off. Someone's gone through a divorce. Someone's lost their parent, you know, so they're in a state of grief. Any current past influences and emotions would go on your map. And the point of reflective parenting is to think a bit about how do they then influence you in your parenting. Now, that might sound like a real piece of work for a parent. You know, we're not putting parents into sort of long-term psychoanalytic therapy. It sounds a bit like maybe we are. But it's as simple as kind of looking back over a situation you had with your teen, perhaps a difficult moment you had over, could have been anything, and unpicking what part of that difficulty belonged to me and where did that come from. Could it be something really basic, like I was just tired? Those things are on your map. They're just as valid. It might be it was 11:30 at night and he wanted a really heavy conversation about his girlfriend with me, and I just sort of said, oh, talk in the morning, you know, I don't want to. And then that led to an argument, and it just might be just overload. You know, I reached my limit. Or it might be something much more about our beliefs about teenagers. You know, maybe if your parents were very permissive with you, or they're very authoritarian, and you're bringing that in consciously or unconsciously into your parenting of your own teenager, then trying to understand your own parent map a little bit would be thinking about, oh, that's actually influences me quite a lot. So if I give a small example from my own life, I was a very studious adolescent, and my brother was the wild one. So I feel like I didn't quite have the crazy adolescence that I envied my brother having. And that's made me think that it's important for adolescents to have a bit more risk, maybe a bit more fun that I might have missed out in my teenagers. But I could have gone the opposite way easily. I might have thought, that's really important that every teenager should be just like me and be you know, studious and quiet and not take risks and so on. And there's all sorts of factors, obviously, that will influence how we parent our teenagers. But the main message is not just all about them. How you are, what influences you right now from the present and the past is playing a really big part in even those little day-to-day moments.
Yes. I think there's a couple things in that I love that. And one of those is a parent just having an awareness that their map is different than their teen's map and that they are a different person than their teen is. And so that you just don't assume that they have to be just like you, or you don't have to have them feel like they have to correct your past. But
yes.
I think the difference can actually bring y'all closer together, especially if you make that about curiosity. And so yes. you could say, you know, like, okay, so when I was in school, and you can make fun of yourself, like, you know, we didn't have, you know, we had phones that had cords in them, you know, and so what's it like for you that and have them, they can be your teacher.
Exactly. Bringing on, switching on the curiosity, you've hit the nail on the head, is the key to understanding that to connect with somebody, naming the difference doesn't have to be, because you hear that so much, don't you? Like, oh, you know, back in my day, we didn't have phones. And there was nothing on the TV. We had to make our own fun. Why can't you? Well, of course they can't, because they've now got all these amazing gadgets and devices and platforms. And there's so much to kind of excite them and entertain them that there's no point saying you need to switch all of that off and be like I was when I was a child. But you can be curious about, do they feel sometimes that they're overloaded with all of that information? Does social media sometimes leave them feeling anxious? And but it's not to say it's all bad, because what I had was better. It's different. Exactly as you say, Colleen, that the curiosity is, and what's that like? And I think once you open up your curiosity, you invite them to say the good and the bad. If you just come in with a judgment that says, well, in my day, we didn't have phones and we were a lot happier, then that just completely invalidates that whole part of their life where they use their phone. You know, if you ask the question, what's it like using TikTok or Facebook, or is that always fun, or is that sometimes a bit frightening? And often they'll sort of say, oh, I like it. Some days it's really fun. Other days I just feel like, oh, it's too much. You're not passing judgment. You're just opening your curiosity, and it allows them to start reflecting on themselves a little bit. That's the other part of reflective parenting, is you're trying to get a teenager who's got this difficulty already in mentalizing to think a little bit, not just about you or others, but about themselves and how they are. Are there things about themselves that they are a bit worried about, or the whole range?
Yeah, so much to go into there. It's so easy, because of fear, for a parent to get into judgment, but judge, that builds up a wall. And so it takes, sometimes it might just, and again, and you might be on that, the edge of the emotional thermometer. So it takes some personal work for mom to, you know, for you to get in kind of the middle ground, so you are able to get curious, which leads to the next question is, why is it harder being a reflective parent with teens?
Well, I mean, lots of reasons, but one of the big ones is because teenagers often don't appreciate our curiosity. It feels like an invasion. So this is back to the kind of cactus image. So where your five-year-old might really love you being curious about what's in their mind. You know, you might say, oh, you're having a great time at the park there. I could see you were really enjoying yourself on the swing. That feels good for a five-year-old. It's like, mom or dad, really, you know, grandma really likes me and what I do. They're really interested in me. The challenge in adolescent parenting is that that feels both good and highly aversive, because what they're trying to do is develop their own individual identity. And that involves some sense of privacy as well. You know, keep out. I'm shutting the door of my room because I don't want you in here. This is my space. And that's probably a metaphor for their life as well. Like, there's a wall between me and you. And the reason that difficult to mentalize somebody at that age is because they don't always want to feel like you understand them. And that's the rub, really, of this, because you're giving that message of, I want to understand you. And part of their need to individuate and develop their own adult identity, their own status within their peer group, is they have to say, I'm not you. I'm not the same as you. I'm different. I'm separate. Sometimes then mentalizing can feel like an invasion. Like, you're trying to get into my mind. You're trying to get into my head. I don't want you in here. And it becomes confusing then for teenagers. So that's why I think it's so hard. And that's why it needs this extra understanding that this push-pull of come close, stay away. It's very hard for us to get that right all the time. We're not going to get it right all the time. And that's something that we have to accept, is that there will be times where it just feels like, keep out. Just a small aside, one of my teenagers, when I was talking about this book and I was trying to think of a title, he suggested that I call it, Please Just Stop Talking. He said that's what all teenagers are thinking when their parents are coming towards them. There you have it, from a teenager's mouth.
No, that's perfect. Okay, so let's follow up on that. So what can parents do? Tips for parents to start to have conversations like the mentalizing and reflectiveness.
I think naming, so what we've just discussed, I think naming that a little bit is helpful. So actually acknowledging that you are interested, that you want to help, that you're curious to find out, and checking, is this, do you want to talk to me? Just asking the question is really important, like gauging a little bit more Is this a good time? Can we go there? Whatever it is, you know, whether it's about drugs or sex or friendships or exams or whatever the topic is, or even something small like their hair, you know, it could be anything, but whatever it is that matters to your teen at any given time, that for them will feel enormous. Even if it is just their hair, it will feel like the most important thing in the world because that's how their focus works, as you know. I think checking in, if you get that signal, kind of back off, mum, don't go there, I think you can still say, well, you know, if you want to talk to me about that, I'm here. And it's about checking rather than just diving in. There's such a kind of impulse to fix, isn't there? You're worried, I'm going to.
I'm laughing because, like, if I have something in my head that I want to talk to my daughter about, and she can go on and on and on and on. I'm a great listener, and she'll talk about everything. And then I just dive in. And she's 28 now, and she'll say, "Oh my gosh, mom, you're a therapist. You like sometimes have the worst timing ever. You know, like, can't you just say, hey, is this a good time to talk about this?" So
There you
exactly what
go.
you're saying. You know, I have done well with that, and I have failed, an epic fail. But I think that's just understanding, like, mom, that self-awareness of you is like you have something that's kind of intense in your head, and you want that answered.
Yeah, exactly. And that's the big part of reflective parenting. It's almost more of it is about understanding your own mind than it is understanding your teenagers. Because once you've understood your own thoughts and feelings and your intentions, what's driving your need to dive in, then you can learn to regulate that a little bit. And your teenager really appreciates that. And sometimes you might just blow it, as we all do. But then if you acknowledge that and just say, oh, that's just me, it's me worrying more about that than you. I feel like I want to fix this right now. Or I want to help you. Do you want me to right now? Or do you want to come back to me when you need me? It's something about saying, you know, you might be slamming the door on me, but my door's always open, that I think is a really important message. They don't want you to burst in the door. And I'm using this metaphorically and literally, you know, don't burst in the bedroom, but actually kind of peep around a little bit and say, I'm here when you want me. I think is such an important thing for teenagers because they want to be the ones that are a bit in control of your, I suppose, curiosity, of your time, of your what they might think of as your invasion of their mind. But you simultaneously need to give that message that's like, I'm not here to rescue you. I talk in the book about it's not a life jacket anymore. It's like you're a harbor. You know, you're not rescuing your teenager and saying, let me make it all good for you, because that can be dangerous too. You're doing everything for them. But you're saying, like, I'm a safe harbor. You can come back to me. I'm always here. You know, you sail off in your little boat, but come back when you need a bit of safety. And that's something that then I think really establishes that sense of attachment security that we've all thought about from when they're very little. It's just as important when they're 21. And you'll know that from having older kids yourself. They still want to call you when they need you.
Yes, they do. So, Sheila, we can talk forever, but I'm going to ask you, what is the last advice do you have for the moms listening?
Stay curious, reflect on yourself first, and then try to think about what's behind their behavior second.
Wonderful. That's great. So I imagine that they can buy your book, How Do You Hug a Cactus, anywhere books are sold.
Yep, it's online and it's at all the major book providers. I'm not sure in the States where that would be, but they can follow me if they want to find out the places that it's available. And I think you're going to put those details in the details of your podcast, aren't you? So it is, I suppose I would just say to parents, it is an accessible read. It's a little bit, hopefully, of a practical guide. There's a bit of theory in there, but it's mostly based around everyday scenarios. And it encourages parents to think about the young people that I talk about in the book of like, what would you feel reading this? What do you feel in this scenario as a parent? So hopefully it actually activates their mentalizing, hopefully reading the book.
Yeah, I think it's an excellent book. I think it's super helpful.
Thanks so much.
Well, thank you so much for your time today. This has been a great discussion.
Thank you very much. I really enjoyed it.
This concludes this week's episode of Power Your Parenting Moms with Teens podcast. If this podcast has been helpful, I would absolutely love it if you could go to Apple Podcasts and leave a 5-star review. This makes it easier for other moms like you to find the support and encouragement they need. Also, my award-winning best-selling books, Dial Down the Drama, Reducing Conflict, Reconnecting with Your Teenage Daughter, and my newest release book, Dollop the Dream, Making Your Daughter's Journey to Adulthood the Best for Both of You. You can find both of these books wherever books are sold. And you can find other great resources and contact me at ColleenO'Grady.com. And that has two L's and two E's.
This podcast is a part of the C-Suite Radio Network. For more top business podcasts, visit c-suiteradio.com.